Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse and progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio...
When I was in Croatia, I was quite astounded at a lot of discussion about, well, how do we make peace? And about militaries bombing for peace, and militaries signing ceasefires and calling them peace. And I think once war has started, it's late in the game to talk about peace. We need to talk about peace before the bombs are dropping.
When speaking of protest, resistance, and activism, it's hard to deny the overarching significance of the 1960s in shaping current thought. For all its cultural baggage, the decade brought with it a form of mass protest seldom seen on the streets of America either before or since. But with the end of the Vietnam War, most Americans were ready for a change. Across the nation, people dropped affiliations, put down their banners, and turned to the often complicated task of moving on with their lives. Tom Cornell is a veteran of the anti-war movement and spoke with us in part two of our series about the roots of resistance. Today, in the third and final segment of our series, he reflects on the aftermath of the 1960s.
We have seen, I think, in the last 20 years, a weakening of the forces, actually. There's a fatigue that set in post-Vietnam and a shift in the realities. Once you get a model all worked out on the basis of the realities that you're confronting, then the realities change, well, and your model isn't any good anymore. And now we're going into a period of globalization on a neoliberal model. Globalization is good and inevitable. And one of the reasons why it gives the promise, the possibility that we can actually get beyond the phenomenon of war if we're sufficiently interdependent politically, economically, and socially across the globe. But globalization on what pattern? If it's a globalization on the laissez-faire capitalist model, the free market model, which now has the upper hand, then we're going to see a marginalization of whole nations, whole peoples, just as we have seen a marginalization in our own country of the weakest and most vulnerable, so that a fifth of our population is really written off. No one should be written off. But when you're talking about a good 20% of your population, you're talking about something that's very, very dangerous, as well as unjust. And if you want to impose this model on the world, we're talking about marginalizing entire countries, especially in Africa and in the so-called developing world. We're talking largely about people of color. Don't we know anything about racism by now? Nonviolence has to address these problems now. We have to work out methods of raising protest, models of withdrawal and non-cooperation, and models of effective nonviolent resistance. Not just cadre actions, little, symbolic kinds of actions of high dramatic quality, but also you have to organize a mass base to demand from a position of political power.
While some would argue his methods, Cornell's call to protest the rise of global neoliberalism is being answered by many on the left. Still, there is little evidence to support his hope that a global economy might preclude the possibility of war. One only has to look at the many armed conflicts waged around the world to see where globalization has led thus far. Catherine Turnipseed is an anti-war and human rights activist who spent 3 years living in Croatia in the mid-1990s. At a recent luncheon at the Revolution Center in upstate New York, she spoke about her experiences in the Balkans and dismisses the notion that the conflict was a purely ethnic one.
I had been told by the media and the politicians before I got there that the wars there were caused by ethnic tension and hatred. And what I learned through my friendships with people, many of whom were in multi-ethnic families, is that the ethnic tension and hatred was more of a consequence of war and not a cause. And it was a tool that was manipulated by politicians, not only in Croatia and Bosnia, but also politicians in the U.S. and throughout Europe. And so when we look at war, we have to look more deeply at what are the roots of war. And I think we often will find that there are political and economic reasons. When I was in Croatia, people were living under tremendous economic hardship that had begun 10 years before when the IMF caused these countries to restructure their economies to repay their loans. They seemed to have no either awareness or concern that their policies were causing great disruption and leading towards war.
Like many during the Vietnam War, Catherine Turnipseed saw the war in the Balkans as resulting from economic injustice on the highest levels. To her, the call was to protest, whether or not the United States became involved militarily. In this sense, her work was truly progressive. She recognized that when war becomes a global reality, we must resist it on a global scale.
The anti-war campaign in Croatia began in 1991, soon after Croatia had declared independence. A handful of people were meeting over coffee, and they decided, we have to do something. Even though they were in a state of shock, they were very much feeling a sense of war is coming, but we can't believe it is coming. And again, Vesna Teresilic was saying, it's like someone tells you you have cancer and you ask, why me? Why now? And so rather than being immobilized by this state of disbelief, the state of shock, they decided to take action. And again, through great personal risk, they decided to speak out against their government, and they organized peace rallies. I think this is the thing I didn't understand about war. People didn't just go to the front line and stay there. People went from their homes to the front line and would come back to their homes. They could be on weekly rotations, two-weekly rotations. So it was very unlike the movies that I had seen. And so one gentleman who was helping with the conscientious objector movement said, if they tell me I have to come home with a gun in my hand, I won't go home. They focused their efforts on anti-war activities, human rights activities, independent media, and humanitarian efforts. Their courage, their patience, their fierce determination all occurred outside the spotlight of the media. So it's possible that you all never heard about them. It's possible that you never heard that in 1997, a person jointly, people from Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. There were great activities happening for peace throughout this time of war. Vesna Teresilic, who's the director of the anti-war campaign in Croatia, reflected on these times, and she said, we recognized that we couldn't stop the war, but we could keep the door open for a civil society. We could keep hope open for a dignified and peaceable existence. And so they worked with teachers in schools, and they worked with children, and they taught them the skills of conflict resolution. They helped nurture the development of 18 anti-war groups throughout Croatia who are working to protect human rights. They were working with women who had survived traumas of war to help them to heal and maybe even to move through to the process of forgiveness. And they were helping to create independent media so that people could have the truth about what was happening. Once the war started, each government took control of the media and used it as a tool of propaganda, just like as it happens in the U.S., to create perceptions of reality. And once that happened, many people were susceptible to hatred and fear. And so we have to look, wherever we are, how to create independent sources of media so that we can have a deeper understanding of what's happened.
When Catherine Turnipseed returned to the United States, her perception that the mass media was propagating a false reality was only reinforced.
I think the thing that has always struck me was when I moved back to the U.S., people said to me, oh, good, welcome home. You're good to be back out of the war zone. And how shocked I was that they could say that, because if you look on the streets of the U.S., there is tremendous violence. You know, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, there are children who hear gunshots, if not nightly, then weekly. And I would definitely say that's not a state of peace. And I visited Sarajevo several times, and hearing all, you know, there were snipers, but at the nighttime, I actually felt safer on the streets of Sarajevo than I would on many places in the United States. You know, and I think for me, that's really something to think about. And so I feel very fortunate to have been able to go over there, and I feel very affirmed that if I want to work for peace in Bosnia and Croatia, I have to work for peace in the United States.
While Turnipseed's story may seem extraordinary, her life before working in the Balkans was the prototypical American dream.
I used to be a commercial banker working on Wall Street. So I luckily, I guess, had my awareness raised as I was working to help these large corporations have loans, but generally the sole purpose of my job was for them not to pay taxes. Reading that and then looking in the newspaper and seeing things like, well, you know, welfare is causing problems, you know, and just finally the dissonance was too much for me. And I really understood that I was a part of the problem. Even more so than I am today, I was part of the problem, and that I really wanted to be a part of the solution. And if you look at our foreign policy, the last thing our government wants us to see, or our corporations, is that we are causing harm, yeah, and that we're responsible for the harm, and that there's... Yeah. So, but I think people can hear it if each of us can be skillful in how we share that message. And I think not to just, I guess the big thing I feel, I recently saw a documentary on war, which I think I mentioned, and it just kind of detailed all the problems and didn't take me through to a place of, well, what can I do about this? And so I think the challenge is when we make that connection to help people see what they can do about it, and not to be pointing fingers, really just to name it, not to be righteous about it. And to give people reason to think that if they tried to do something, they could make a difference. Because otherwise, I think we risk just adding to the overwhelm that people feel. Because our society, our way of living, our values have created so many problems now that they can really be overwhelming if you can't find a way to sustain yourself in doing your little bit. Like, I think, okay, I want to end war. I want to end militarism. It used to be very hard for me to get that I'm not going to see that in my lifetime. Because I'm a good, you know, American citizen. I'm a good capitalist. I want success. I'm not going to see it. I'm not going to be able to bring an end to war on my own. You know, at one point, I really thought that that's, you know, I should have been able to end the war in Croatia, which is absolutely absurd. And it divorced me from saying, and I'm doing my little part, and my little part is important, and I can feel good about that. And so I think that's a big part of it, too, to just say, let's all just find out what's our little part.
You're listening to Bruggerhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program broadening the bounds of discourse and progressive thought and action. If you have questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruggerhof. In speaking with Catherine Turnipseed, it seems fair to say that Americans protesting wars today need to adopt a completely new model for resistance. As globalization erodes the barriers between nation-states, transnational corporations steadily increase their foreign influence and often begin to control entire foreign governments. The first sign of this new model of protest came in November 1999, when crowds of protesters convened at the ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle. To many, it represented not only a resurgence of mass organizing, but also the introduction of new tactics to fight a new reality. Some of these tactics involved the destruction of property and were aimed specifically at corporations known to be international human rights and environmental abusers. Mainstream media attention was focused primarily on the so-called violent protesters, although evidence shows that law enforcement officials perpetrated the most brutal violence. Last December, Mike Thornton of KVMR Radio in Nevada City, California, interviewed Rose Braz, a San Francisco lawyer who attended the week of protests in Seattle. They spoke about the tactics used in the WTO protests.
Rose, let's talk, if we will, about the issue of what is protest and perhaps what's not, what is effective and what's not. And there seems to be a certain mentality that if you're quote-unquote nonviolent, that's okay, and then if you break property, that is no longer legitimate protest, at least in some circles that is being said. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think we really need to differentiate between we need to define what is violence and what is vandalism. To me personally, violence is not a broken window at the Gap. It's vandalism. It's against the law. If you do it, you're going to face some penalty for that in our criminal justice system, and you need to be cognizant of that. But to me personally, that is not violence. Violence is the fact that, a little girl in Haiti gets paid 11 cents a day to manufacture Pocahontas pajamas for Disney that are sold for $22. I think that we really need to define that. And that's one issue. The other issue is, what's effective and what's not. And I certainly don't always agree that property destruction is an appropriate means of protest. On the other hand, you look back at the Boston Tea Party, for example, when that was a form of property destruction, direct action. You look at the plowshares actions of folks going in and destroying nuclear armaments directly. That's vandalism. That's destruction of property.
So what I'm hearing you say is, let me see if I can, because I just want to get this straight if I can. Had the protest taken place without the direct action attack at the property, do you think it wouldn't have been as effective?
I think it would not have been as effective in bringing world attention to the WTO. Yeah, I do believe that.
Let's, if we can, talk about tactics, if we will, because while I don't necessarily disagree with the premise of forcing corporations to pay a real physical price, a real physical manifestation of protest, such as what happened. What I have a problem with is that I think that conducting it within the context of the other protest, I think was a mistake, in my opinion. I think if this was going to be done, it should have been done at a different time where it was clear, where it was separate, and then some sort of communique was released afterwards saying, this is why we did it, this is why it happened, and that it was a very clear thing, not in the midst of all of this other stuff going on. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I guess I believe that, within the scope of almost any demonstration, there are people, you have a demonstration, some people come and walk on the sidewalk, some people walk in the streets, some people block an intersection, some people sit down and risk arrest, some people go cooperatively to the bus or the van, when they're arrested, other people go limp. I think it's a rare occasion when you have, it's a rare occasion and it's a small demonstration when you have a complete unity of tactical decision making, when everybody's on exactly the same page.
Right.
I think those situations certainly occur, and they're powerful situations, but I think in the context of the WTO situation, that just could never happen. I think you had, upwards of 50 to 100,000 people there. I really don't know how many people were there,
right.
But you had people, in all sorts of, you had the labor folks who had a, rally over at this near the Space Needle, who marched to the direct action site. You had the direct action folks, you know, who were in front of the light linking arms. You had people in the streets who were locked down to property, you know, to whatever things in the middle of the intersections to block traffic. So I think that, you know, there are some basic principles, which to me are like, you know, nobody gets physically hurt, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think it's a hard-pressed thing to control the actions of all folks. And I think generally, you know, with some caveats being, you know, no physical harm to anybody, that we have to respect the fact that different demonstrators take on different tactics. And we have to recognize also that the role of the quote-unquote extremists play in legitimizing the folks who, you know, are there negotiating with the police, who are there sweeping up the glass the next day. And I think that those folks are, you saw just by Thursday, Clinton was offering to meet with the good demonstrators.
Right.
Clinton was making speeches about the good demonstrators. He condemned the violence, but he, you know, supported the people in the streets who were the good demonstrators, who came here peacefully, blah, blah, blah. So I think that those folks need to at least acknowledge the role of the so-called extremists in, you know, facilitating their power.
Well, it's interesting because I think back to many, many years ago, and I think back to a statement I'm obviously paraphrasing, made by Malcolm X, where he said, you know, that lots of at that time, white America said, well, we better do business with Martin Luther King because the alternative is me. And
exactly.
And I'm hearing, really, you say almost the same thing, correct?
Correct, yeah. I guess, you know, I don't think we're going to have unification of forces on the left. I don't even think we need that, but I guess I feel like we need some just basic level of respect, a basic understanding of who the enemy is, you know, and a basic goal of not, feeding into the enemy's line of oppression, you know, which would be arrest, prosecution, you know, denouncing, all of those things are not productive. You know, it's, as I said, it's fine to say, I disagree with those actions. And, you know, I've certainly said those things in the past myself, you know, but it's another thing to call for arrest and prosecution of people who are out on the streets demonstrating with you.
In the end, what defined Seattle was not so much the techniques used, but the targets of the protest. Moreover, the protesters showed a level of education about the core issues that can perhaps be attributed only to the dissemination of information over the Internet. But whatever form it takes, protest is, and always will be, born out of social struggle. And the important thing, says Tom Big Warrior, a veteran activist, is that we learn from the past.
I mean, I think a lot of people had a hard time understanding. You know, our understandings were pretty simplistic in the 60s. And the problems are pretty complex. It's like when, capitalism being restored in Eastern Europe and Russia, the new rulers in China that are taking the capitalist road and all that, people weren't prepared for that. You know, they expected that history was going to move forward in a straight line and it was all going to be onward and upward and better and better. Instead of seeing that there's an ebb and flow and that things don't move forward in a straight line, that for each new insight and new awareness that we get as a society, there's also a backlash that, you know, throws us back on our heels. And, it's not over until it's over. You know, it's a long, protracted struggle for society to move from where it is now to where, you know, the people on the left would like it to be, you know.
Catherine Turnipseed agrees. She says that no matter what form our protest takes, or even what we are protesting, be it world war, regional conflict, American imperialism, or global economic homogeneity, what really matters is that we do something and that we start at home.
We can do something wherever we are. And I think the point is we have to be peace. We can't make peace. When I was in Croatia, I was quite astounded at a lot of discussion about, well, how do we make peace? And about militaries bombing for peace, and militaries signing ceasefires and calling them peace. And I think once war has started, it's late in the game to talk about peace. We need to talk about peace before the bombs are dropping. We need to look at the United States and ask, in a country with great wealth, why is there so much poverty and so much violence? And how does the violence that children experience nightly in cities across this country contribute to a war in Bosnia? When we nurture the seeds of war here, we nurture the seeds of war throughout this planet. And similarly, when we nurture the seeds of peace and love and kindness and generosity, we nourish the seeds of peace and love and kindness and generosity across this planet. And so I'd like to suggest that the process of being peace is the practice of being peace. And it's something that we each can do every moment of every day. And we need to hold on to the hope and the belief that by practicing peace where we are, it makes a difference all across this planet, and that it makes a difference to the children here today and their children and their children's children. And so on this day where we honor Dr. Martin Luther King, and I think I just saw another quote that I had of his that I'd like to share with you. He said, "If we assume that life is worth living, if we assume that mankind has a right to survive, then we must find an alternative to war."
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, where we wrapped up our three-part discussion of activism, resistance, and protest movements in the 20th century. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman with writing and additional research by Ben Wright. Thanks to Mike Thornton of KVMR Radio for additional material. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 800-778-8461. To order tapes and transcripts, call that same number. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For further information about the Bruderhof Communities, call 1-800-778-8461.